Grade 5, Teaching Botany, Part 3. It's perhaps typical of Rudolf Steiner's approach to anything that it would be counterintuitive in many respects. So we might imagine if we are going to teach children about the nature of plants, well, we'd want to start with the simplest plants, that is the way most things are taught today in the life sciences, start from the cell or the parts of the cell, or maybe even on the molecular or subatomic level, whatever, and build up, you know, show how things developed, how they turned into something else. And though from an earthly point of view, that's not entirely incorrect, Steiner is giving us a more cosmic approach. And he's basically saying that Goethe's Urpflanze, the primal plant, which is a flowering plant with full leaves and stems and roots, that was the first plant, that was, as it were, the sun, the essence of sun evolution was that plant. It's been around for a long, long time. It just has not come onto the earth until relatively recently. So that things that appear to be the result of the hard, industrious labor of lower organisms, which finally, in one way or another, in, you know, systems theory, band together and create something bigger and better than themselves, that's what it looks like from the earthly perspective. But from the cosmic perspective, you start at the top. You start with the best. You start with the archetype. And gradually, conditions of earthly life make it possible for that archetype to start to touch the earth, to start to, as it were, incarnate, so that we can see it. So the flowering plant, which in evolutionary terms is a fairly new development on the earth, actually has been watching the unfolding of plant life on the earth for a long, long time. So that is where we begin, with the flowering plant. And as you will see in the slideshow of student work in the subject of botany, before we even took up the study of the plant, we were already beginning to paint the flowering plant using the slow method of wet paint on dry paper rather than just sloshing the water all around. So we were, as it were, you could say, building up the plant with color, or you could say we were allowing that plant to find its home on our paper. We were unfolding it. It's there in the ether, and the colors were just helping to coax it onto the earth. So we painted it, and by the time we started the block, everyone had already done a painting. Some had done some other paintings in the autumn landscape in nature on their own before we started the block. And then we work with the flowering plant and the nature of its balance, as we said, balanced between the darkness of the earth and the sun-filled light. The plants grow almost everywhere on the planet. The words plant and planet are similar, because nothing lives on earth without a plant somehow sustaining it. So we see plant and earth, and also this interplay of light and darkness, and we take up the flowering plant as our model. And then right away we go into the picture of metamorphosis in the life and the growth of the plant. And we see the way in which the plant's growth is connected again and again with contraction, expansion. And you'll see a couple of diagrams that the children did in their books, which work with this, that we start with the seed, and it's very good to bring in many seeds to the children. Those you're allowed to bring in separate from the earth. And it's very interesting that the seed, which needs the earth, of course, in order to assert its organicity, its organic life, it's also, of any part of the plant, it's the most independent of the earth. It's the part that can be sustained. It's the life that's in it, though it is so deeply asleep that it's almost imperceptible, that can persist for a long time. And when we were studying Egyptian history, I mentioned to the children that after Tutankhamun's tomb was discovered, that a lot of seeds were found to be in that tomb. And actually, these seeds in time were distributed to plant scientists, biologists, all over the world to study. And one of them, a man named Ehrenfried Pfeiffer, decided that the Egyptians had probably exposed these seeds to the light of certain stars, very likely Sirius, and maybe to the light of planets as well. And that these planetary forces built up the life of these seeds to the degree that 3,000 years after being buried in the tomb, wheat seeds from those tombs could still sprout. They could still germinate. They were still viable. That's pretty incredible. I don't know what other scientists did with this or about it, but I do know that Ehrenfried Pfeiffer worked with these wheat grains that he was given and actually developed a new strain of wheat, which is called to this day Pfeiffer wheat. There's not a whole lot of it on the earth. I have actually had the privilege of planting some seeds of the Pfeiffer wheat and watching them as they germinated and produced incredible grain. The one problem was, and one reason that there's so little Pfeiffer wheat extant, the birds from miles around came and got it. We could not put any number of nets around that would defeat them. They would practically kill themselves in their wish to eat of that veritably sacred wheat. Very, very interesting. Okay, so the Egyptians found a way of keeping wheat viable for 3,000 years. How long is a grain of modern wheat viable? 1 to 2 years. And of course, now that there's all kinds of GMO work going on, they're making sure that it's only viable for 1 year. So you've got to go and buy more again and again. Quite interesting. Here we are, as I mentioned in the ancient cultures lectures, reliving Egyptian life, trying to counterbalance it. And I guess we're really counterbalancing it there, creating seeds that are hardly alive at all, that have no etheric forces. So here we see the life of the seed, this contraction, which approaches being mineral in nature. And of course, the seed will always have a connection with the mineral world and even needs for most plants to be placed in the earth, in the soil, to be able to grow and germinate, and to look at seeds and see if the children know or can guess what plant is going to come out of it. It's very rare that a seed tells us much about the remarkable richness and beauty and nourishment that it carries. And then we look at the expansion in the cotyledon, this delicate expansion, which is very uniform, kind of archetypal. You can't always tell from cotyledons what's coming next either. Little bit like a baby. All babies basically look the same, though their mothers can tell their cries apart. And so it is with these cotyledons. And then the cotyledon seems to come to a stop. Its growth seems to stop for a day or two or more. And that's when the bud appears. And the bud seems hard and fixed. Almost sometimes it looks like a seed on the little stem. And then it bursts open and the first true leaves begin to appear. And they grow rhythmically, contracting, expanding, contracting, expanding. And then their growth seems to stop entirely as the calyx comes and perhaps rests very much at the top of the plant, breathing in, sleeping, resting before that beautiful expansion of the flower, that wonderful breathing out into the light and the air. And then we see in the flower, after its expansive, lush growth, these skinny little forms, the stamen and the pistils. Again, such a contraction, so small, almost not there physically. And then the swelling and the coming forth of the fruit, which if it's allowed to fully ripen and not eaten first, gives us again the final contraction of the seed. To give the children this thought exercise, to let them imaginatively follow the life of the plant in that way. This is one of the most important things that you do in botany. If I were giving you the sort of thing I did with Greece, you know, a 1 week botany class, a 2 week botany class, I would say for the 1 week, if you just can get to metamorphosis, that would be fine. And if you could look at some plants, maybe that are still out, and see if the children can see any connection between the form of the lower leaves and the upper leaves, between the form of the upper leaves and the calyx, and between the calyx and the flower, and the lower leaves and the flower, and so on. Waldorf children who've done a lot of form drawing should have the capacity to be able to perceive things like this. And then you can go in different directions from this point as you've given them this basic principle of metamorphosis. So for example, you might want to go straight into the sort of taxonomy of the flowering plant and look at its component parts. You might want to start with the world on the mountain, which is illustrated in the slideshow, showing how the upper part of the mountain is root-like and the lower part's very much like the flower, even the fruit. You might want to take a common plant like the dandelion, and which still might be out and flourishing even in the autumn, certainly will be there early in the spring, and show them all of its component parts. So here you have a lot of freedom and possibility. What we did was actually to go into the world of two kinds of flowering plants, the monocotyledons and the dicotyledons, and to compare them, and in this way, really look at the threefold nature of the plant. So we saw how the monocotyledons are, in every respect, a simpler kind of plant. The grasses in particular are very representative of them. And the many wonderful bulb plants that we will see in the spring or that we might have been planting around the school grounds in the autumn, monocotyledons, with their simple leaves, their parallel veins, the stem that goes deeply into the earth and results in the tuber, as in the iris or in the bulb, as in the tulip, with a very relatively short and tight little root system, not penetrating deeply in the earth. Steiner has said that the tuber and the bulb store last year's sunlight. That's why these plants can often blossom so early in the year. They're not depending on this year's sunlight. They're carrying within them a memory of last year's. They're always looking backwards, and Steiner connects them actually more to the moon than the sun. We think of the lily And you might want to even bring in some artistic representations of these plants. The lily we can see in many, many an Annunciation painting being held by the Archangel Gabriel before the Virgin Mary, the lily, which is this picture of purity, but also a picture of conception, a picture of new life to come. And we might say that the representation strongly coming to us as human beings from the monocotyledons are the grains, because the grains all come from grasses, and the grasses are all monocotyledons. And this is what gives us our bread. So the monocotyledons, they are, as it were, the bread basket of the earth. The dicotyledons, on the other hand, here we see very strong, deep root systems. Here we see stems that are not watery and fibrous, but are rather strong and hard and woody very often. Even in a flower as delicate as the rose, what a strong, woody stem it develops over time. Here in their four and five-foldness, they're even geometrically, mathematically quite different from the three and six-foldness of the flowers of the monocotyledon. Their leaves are more complex, more varied, often serrated with branching veins. And these are the plants that give us the wonderful fragrant flowers such as the rose and the carnation and a host of others. And they also give us the fruits. So the dicotyledon gives us the fruit, the rose hip, the orange, the grape. The dicotyledon gives us wine, the wine that goes together so well with bread. And we could see how the communion, and this is not only Christian, but in many religions or faith traditions, as we call them nowadays, in many of these religious traditions, one has something of the wine or even just grape juice and the bread. So the monocotyledon and the dicotyledon represent these two poles of the evolution of the flowering plant into something which is, as it were, gives us a chance to once again commune with the sun. And then from there, we look more deeply at the nature of the flower, of the stem, and of the root. And then we took our journey, our walk up the mountain, at least imaginatively, though some of the children had actually done it. And in our fifth grade class trip, which was a hike, even in New York State, where a major mountain might be 3,000 feet high, where the tallest mountain in the state is the height of Denver, Colorado, a mile high or thereabouts. Even there, though, we could see the difference in the life of the plants and the structure of the plants. So it doesn't take much to bring that to the children's observation. And with this, we ended our first block in botany. And I'll go on in the next lecture to talk about the second part.